Our text for this morning can be found in the book of Romans, chapter 1. I should have said the first chapter of Romans. That would have come out right. But Romans chapter 1, we'll begin reading with the 13th verse. Romans chapter 1, and beginning to read with verse 13. As you're turning there, let me mention that it's always a joy and a privilege to be able to preach for you. And while I, like you, I'm sure, would enjoy our pastor being with us today to preach for us, it's great. It's good for him to be able to have some relaxation and refreshment on vacation, and I appreciate the opportunity to fill in while he is out. Romans chapter 1, and we'll begin reading with verse 13 and read all the way to the end of the chapter. Romans 1, beginning with verse 13. I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. I am under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and the foolish, so I am eager to preach the gospel for you also who are in Rome. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, that is in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they knew God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, that they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God shall stand forever. Some 40 years ago, Francis Schaeffer wrote a book and also created a video series under the title, How Should We Then Live? How Should We Then Live was kind of a tour de force in which Schaeffer looked at the history of Western civilization going back to the ancient Greeks and coming forward to the current. And his thesis was that worldviews have an impact on the continuance of societies. And so as part of that, he contended that in Western civilization, we had thrived for a number of centuries because of the impact of Christianity on the worldview of the West. and that in recent decades, maybe recent centuries, that impact was being dissipated, and the fact that the Christian impact on Western civilization was being reduced, that there were going to be consequences for that occurrence. Schaeffer's book has sort of become a modern classic, and so even though the book is some 40 years old, it continues to be somewhat widely read. A little over a decade ago, Charles Colson and Nancy Piercy attempted to follow up on Schaeffer's work, and they wrote a book with the title, How Now Shall We Live? So from how should we then live to how now shall we live? And Colson's thesis was, well, we've gone a couple of decades farther down the road, and Western society has degenerated into postmodernism. And so it's important for Christians to continue to assert a Christian worldview against a postmodernism that will be destructive to our civilization. And so that was the thesis that Colson put forward. His book was widely read. It was well received, I think, by many at the time, although it's not achieved the status that Schaeffer's earlier book had read. As I mentioned, people continue to read Schaeffer's book. If you're not familiar with it, it might be something that you want to pick up sometime. And while Colson's book was good, it's never achieved the notoriety, or it's not had the ongoing readership that Schaeffer's did. But nonetheless, we had Schaeffer 40 years ago asking, how should we then live? And Colson asking, how now shall we live? And now we're another decade down the road, and Christians continue to find themselves wondering, with all of that's happened in the past decade, how shall we live? And isn't that a crucial question for all of us as we face the changes in direction in our society, as people ponder national impacts and all that sort of thing? In many ways, our actual questions need to be quite practical. In a world in which we live now, what does it mean to do church or to be a church? How do I raise my family? How do I go out and practice my vocation? How shall I live as a believer in the kind of world in which we're living? That's a bigger subject than I plan to take on this morning. That would require a whole lot of sermons or perhaps books or a long period of time to try to work through all of that. But I do want to do some work that hopefully will provoke some thought, just in terms of just some beginning thinking in terms of what does the Bible say about the worldview that we bring into our lives that helps us to understand in practical terms how shall we live in the world in which we live. Now, there are some Christians, there are some thinkers that are starting to try to answer that question. I think that in light of recent events, that the first thing that we saw many Christian writers doing was just lament what has happened or express sadness over what has been lost. But I think that there are people that are starting to realize, well, it's not enough just to look back and think, well, it was much better than now, and we've lost so much. What's the way forward from here? And so we find some people that are offering some different kind of answers. And in recent weeks, I've read articles by a couple of really good writers addressing this subject. And like I say, they're really good writers. And I decided I disagreed with both of them just because I like taking on a challenge. Or maybe I just like being difficult. And so I just wanted to mention these, and then we will jump into our text and talk and look at what our text teaches us about the world in which we live. And so there's a political writer who's also an active Christian. He used to write for the National Review and now writes for other conservative publications. His name is Rod Dreher. And Rod Dreher has put forth something called the Benedict Option, which is not named after the recent Pope Benedict, but rather it's the idea of the Benedict that founded the Benedictine monasteries. And so Dreher's solution for what Christians should be doing now is essentially, well, the world around us says that they don't want us, and so we should give them what they want. And so instead of remaining actively engaged in our communities and in our nation, we should simply just back off and say, you don't want us, we will form our own communities, we will work among ourselves within our own communities, and if you don't want us, we'll give you the chance to see what that looks like. That was Dreher's response, and it's created a lot of discussion. If you read a lot of stuff on the internet and through blogs and that sort of thing, Dreher has created a lot of discussion with that sort of thing. One of the people that responded to Dreher is Marvin Olasky, who is the editor, I don't know his exact title, with World Magazine. If you're not familiar with World, you probably should be. They do some really good work. But Olasky responded to Dreher by saying, well, I think that he said that's the wrong response. And essentially, Olasky's argument was, it's too soon for that. We still have the opportunity for influence. We still have the opportunity to win elections. We still have the opportunity to influence our culture. And therefore, the Benedict option is not something that Christians should be doing. We should be continuing to try to exercise whatever influence that we can. I agree with Olasky that the Benedictine option is not the right idea. I, in part, at least, disagree with his reasoning. For this reason, the Benedictine option is not a Christian one, whether we retain the capacity to influence culture and elections and Main Street or not. Because the fact of the matter is that Christ has given to the church the Great Commission, and he has given to believers the great commandment to love our neighbor as ourselves. And the Great Commission stands, and the Great Commandment stands, whether we find our culture around us appealing or appalling. Regardless, we have a duty to fulfill the Great Commission by preaching the gospel, by baptizing, and by teaching our disciples to observe all things that he has commanded. And we as a church and as believers have a responsibility to love our neighbor as ourselves. And you can't fulfill the Great Commission and you can't love your neighbor by withdrawing away from them. Now, there may be reason to talk about what love of neighbor looks like. Certainly we understand, if not from our neighborhoods, certainly many of us understand, even within our own families, that loving is not the same thing as enabling. And so there can be the need for discussion as to what love of neighbor looks like. But we do know that we can't love our neighbor by evading him. We can't love our neighbor by withdrawing from him. We cannot fulfill the Great Commission by walking away and saying best of luck to you. We have the responsibility before God of sharing the gospel and of loving our neighbor as ourselves. There is no Christian way of taking our dolls and going home. Or to put it in a different light that sometimes is being seen in the modern world, there is no Christian way of going John Galt. If we are to fulfill the commands of Christ, if we are to fulfill the duty of Christ as the redeemed people of Christ, then it is necessary that we engage our world preaching the gospel and loving our neighbor as we love ourselves. That's Christianity 101, and we cannot forsake those duties as the redeemed of God. So in light of that, let's look at our text together, and I want us to see that in many ways the world in which we live is not an unexpected one. It is the world in which Paul himself engaged, And it's the kind of world that Paul warns us here is the natural consequence of the fall. Paul here in this passage nowhere mentions Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden and the fall of man there. But really, understood biblically, we can see that what he talks about in the latter half of Romans 1 is the consequence of what happened to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and the spread of their sin across all of mankind. And so we see in the passage, beginning with verse 18, what I'm going to refer to as a downward arc. And it is a downward arc that the tendency is to start with the moral failures, the moral condition of mankind that Paul talks about through all of these verses. But it's important to realize that the moral failure is a symptom. It's not the root cause of a problem that produces the wrath of God. The root cause, rather than being moral failure, is a doctrinal failure or a theological failure that affects mankind. And so let's read again, beginning with verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. So you notice what Paul is arguing here is that everybody across the face of the earth, everybody that has basic mental capabilities, has an understanding of who God is. And they have an understanding of who God is because they can look at the created world around them and see evidence of an all-powerful, all-wise, ruling God. There's evidence of that all around them. Notice here that the emphasis of the passage is that knowledge of God is not a matter of human discovery. It's not that people went into the woods and found God somewhere in their search. But rather, it is a matter of divine revelation. God has reached out to us and shown himself to us. And so, it's not discovery where mankind went into the woods and found God, but it's revelation where God came out of the woods and said, "Hey, here I am for all to see." John Calvin put it this way. He said, "There is within the human mind, and indeed by divine instinct, an awareness of divinity. Ignorance of them prevents no one from seeing more than enough of God's workmanship in his creation to lead them to break forth in admiration of the artificer." And so people have innately and through the creation that they see this basic knowledge of God that then they forsake. And so in the ancient world, instead of seeing, hey, to understand what I see around me, there must be an all-wise, all-powerful, ruling God that made all of this. Instead, in the ancient world, they made pygmy gods that were more like them, or even like themselves, or even like the animals around them. They had no resemblance to something that was all-powerful and all-wise and that ruled over all things. And so in the ancient world, you had this suppression of knowledge of God, so that instead of seeing someone all-wise and all-powerful, they created their gods in miniature. And even though we don't, in our modern world, our neighbors around us don't create these images of God, we find much of the same thing, with perhaps the worst of it involving this obsession with the God within myself. And so you see people imagining that God is whatever I make him out to be, and if I have powerful enough thoughts, I can create my own reality. I can create my own destiny with my own belief in an inner God, a God that is inside me. It's just like in the ancient world is pantheism. It's just dressed up a little bit differently. And so people know about the real God, but they suppress the truth they have because the real God, who is all-powerful, who is all-wise, who rules over all things and who creates with purpose, is a threat to our autonomy, and people don't want their personal autonomy threatened. Andrew Lloyd Webber, in one of the versions of The Phantom of the Opera, wrote these words: close your eyes, for your eyes will only tell the truth. And the truth isn't what you want to see. In the dark, it is easy to pretend that the truth is what it ought to be. And that is what the world around us has done. The truth about God is clearly seen, but it is inconvenient. And so it is set aside, and people would prefer to worship or to think about a God who is domesticated, one that is manageable, one that can serve their purposes rather than we serve his. And so this is not surprising. Our own confession of faith points out that what we know about God by nature is not sufficient to save us, because we, in our fallen human nature, we turn that knowledge inside out and we set it aside, we suppress it. And so the Westminster Confession of Faith says, although the light of nature and the works of creation and providence do so manifest the goodness, wisdom, and power of God as to leave men excusable, yet they are not sufficient to give that knowledge of God and of his will which is necessary unto salvation. The light that we have from nature is not enough for us to save ourselves by looking to it, because we suppress that knowledge. But it's only enough rope to hang ourselves, because we see enough that we ought to know, and yet we suppress it and we do not follow it, which is the reason that the light of the gospel that we will see Paul also talks about here is necessary. And so we have as a root cause the suppression of knowledge of God, and Paul then talks about the impact of that, and he has a series of sins that he talks about that really speak to the defacement of our entire humanity. And so in verse 24, our bodies are dishonored. Therefore, God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies. And then in verse 26, our passions are dishonored. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. And then in verse 28, our minds are debased. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. And so our bodies, our emotions, our thinking, all have been dishonored and debased by the impact of sin. Now, looking at it that way, are sinners perpetrators or victims? Or all of the above? All of the above. Augustine said that every disordered soul is its own punishment. And so while we may be angered at the sin around us, or angered at the sin in our own lives, and we wonder, and we should not simply let people off the hook, if you will, because people are knowing perpetrators of sin. But we should also look at our family and our friends and our neighbors around us and understand, just as they are perpetrators, they are victims who debase themselves, who dishonor themselves, who punish themselves with sin's impact on the mind, on the body, and on the passions. This is the condition of mankind that we have fallen into because of sin. The other question that I would have us to ask of our text, and I'm looking at the clock and realizing I need to move quickly. But the other question I want to ask of our text is this. Paul gives a long laundry list of types of sins that are prevalent in society. He certainly is not saying that every person is guilty of each and every one of these things. But it's kind of a list of the kinds of things that we see in society. And I suppose that we may be inclined to focus on the more prurient ones that are mentioned here, but some of these things like gossip and malice are not prurient, but they are nevertheless significant parts of our modern world, and they should not be ignored even while we pay attention to the others. But the question I want to ask of our text and answer is, why did Paul list this particular group of sins? Why did he come up with this one? Why did he mention the things that he talked about and not mention other kinds of things? Where did Paul get this? And not intending to be glib about it, I would say simply that Paul got this particular list by looking out the window where he was living, where he had been teaching, where he had been preaching. Paul wrote Romans from Corinth, and in Corinth, the phrase Corinthian girl was a euphemism meaning a prostitute. In the temple worship of the pagan deities, they engaged in sexual immorality as a part of their worship. It was a commercial city that had the same kinds of reputations that commercial cities sometimes do in our own day. And so Paul in his preaching had gone to Corinth, and he had gone to Athens, and he had gone to Thessalonica, and he had gone to Ephesus, these great commercial cities. And he was not blind to the sin that was all around him as he preached in these places. He got the, it was, if he were in our day, Paul would be preaching in Bangkok and in Amsterdam and in San Francisco and in Las Vegas. And dare I say, in Dallas. And so he saw all of these sins around him, and he's describing the world in which he lived. He's describing the world in which Christians are raising their families. He's describing the world in which Christians go to work every day. It's the world in which they lived. And by the way, it's the world out of which their converts came. Paul gives a similar list of sins in 1 Corinthians 6. And then he adds the words, and such were some of you. This is where the gospel's been preached. This is where the gospel has gone out. This is the world that you lived. But now you've been called out of that by the grace of God through the gospel. And now you are not belonging to that world, but you're belonging to the kingdom of Christ. It's the world out of which you've been called, and you've been called to something else. Which all is a reminder that the divine answer to all of this, the divine answer to the downward arc that we see, is the gospel of Christ. That's the great contrast that Paul is presenting in Romans 1. It's not the difference between the unrighteousness of men and the righteousness of men. It's not that Paul's saying, get out of San Francisco and go to Salt Lake City. Or in the ancient world, he's not saying, get out of Rome and go to Mount Sinai. But rather, the contrast is between the unrighteousness of men and the righteousness of God. And when we say that, it's important to remember Luther's wonderful discovery in the Reformation, that the righteousness of God here in Romans 1 is not just the righteousness that God requires, but it's the righteousness that God gives freely by His grace in the gospel. The answer to mankind's great sin is not a program of moral improvement, although that may be the end, that will be the end result. But the answer to mankind's great sin, the answer to mankind's downward arc, is the gospel of Christ. which is the power of God that leads to salvation for everyone that believes. And so how is it that we shall live in a world that's on the ark in which our world is in? Well, in many ways, it's the same way that we shall live in any kind of world through all of human history, whether the culture appeals to us or whether it appalls us, whether we see a great working of the gospel immediately around us or whether we see things seeming to go backwards. The church still does its ordinary work of preaching the word, administering the sacraments, preparing its members to go out and live in the world in which we live, teaching us to observe all things. The church still does that work. And we, as Christians, continue to raise our families, teaching our children the faith, teaching our children, both in terms of doctrine and practice, what Christianity is, raising them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And then in our vocations, living a life that shows love for neighbor as ourselves, and that where necessary confronts our neighbor with the claims of the gospel where appropriate, but that always also seeks to make common cause with our neighbor when it's possible and appropriate. It's easy to look at the changes that are occurring right around us and be pessimistic. But I would suggest to you that that's not an appropriate response. I'm not usually accused of being overly optimistic. I'm kind of the Prince of Darkness. But not the Prince of Darkness of Luther's hymn. Not the Prince of Darkness Grimm, I trust. But I'm reminded in the Bible of Elijah, who got depressed and said, "I'm the only one that's left." And God said to Elijah, "There are more than 500 prophets that have not bowed their knee to Baal. You're not alone." It's good for us to remember that the kingdom of God is made up of people of every people and tribe and kindred and tongue and nation. It's a worldwide kingdom of all peoples that are brought into Christ's kingdom. I read recently that there are more conservative Presbyterians in Mexico than there are in the United States. Isn't that a wonderful thing? That God is... I was preaching several weeks ago out at Greenville and met a woman that's a member of our PCA church in Greenville who's from Mexico City. And I asked her, I said, "Our church supports a missionary that's been in Mexico City, Peter Dishman. Do you know Peter?" She said, "I had no idea he was so famous till I moved to the United States. Everybody up here asks me about Peter." The gospel's going out in Mexico. I read recently that there are more Reformed Christians in Nigeria than there are in all of North America. And, you know, in our self-centered world, we may think, "Well, Nigeria, what's that?" I read just this last week that by 2050, Nigeria will be the third most populous country in the world. And there are more Reformed Christians in Nigeria than there are in all of North America. The gospel's going out. The gospel's not in retreat. The kingdom of God is not failing. The gospel is winning. And here in our culture, while there are people that will reject us, that will turn their back on us, where perhaps we will see persecution as we have never seen before, we are also going to find people that recognize their need for forgiveness, their need to escape guilt, their need for something that's different from what they have, and there will be fertile soil for people to hear the gospel. Let me tell a cute story to the extent I can, and then I'll be done. A couple of years ago, when Jonathan Beard was getting married, Lynette and I were at the rehearsal dinner. And there was a couple sitting next to Lynette that we didn't know. And the woman was holding her little baby in her arms. And all of a sudden, the baby got our attention. See, I told you it was a cute story. The baby got our attention because she had the most perplexed look on her face. And she had a napkin in her hand, and she was wiping the napkin on Lynette's arm with this concerned look on her face. And her parents and we were watching the child wondering, what in the world, what's this about? What's she thinking? And then it finally occurred to somebody, and we all started laughing when we realized that baby was trying to wipe the freckles off of Lynette's arm and just couldn't understand why it was dirt that wouldn't go away. We live in a culture where a lot of people are not going to understand what ails them. But then it's going to occur that they have this sin. They have this guilt. They have this dirt that will not go away. The gospel, the message, the announcement of Christ's death and resurrection is the power of God for salvation for every soul that believes. There's much more that needs to be said. Maybe I'll get a chance to say it sometime in the future. I'm sure Pastor Boxerman, he covers these things week by week through the faithful preaching of the Word. There's much more to be said about how shall we live, and there's nuance and all of that. But we need not forget, we must not forget this baseline understanding that the gospel is what we have to offer in a world in such desperate need. How shall we live? With confidence in the power of the gospel. Let's pray.